Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is thrilled for the second year in a row to be able to send you to
Louder Than Life. Here in Louisville, Kentucky, we've got four-day wristbands for a winner, somebody.
September 26th through the 29th. Go ahead and put it on your calendar, the Highland Festival Grounds in Louisville, Kentucky. The lineup is insane. I'll throw a few, you throw a few. Ready? I'm going to go Slayer, Disturbed, Motley Crue, Judas Priest, Slipknot.
Korn, Mastodon, Sum 41, Clutch, Sponge, Body Count.
Here's what you got to do. You got to send us an email to wearetheStoryGuys@gmail.com and tell us your favorite music festival story so far. Something you've experienced, seen, done at a music festival. Because, you know, we're the story guys. We like to encourage you to keep telling stories. So tell a story to us, and you could be going to make more stories at Louder Than Life, September 26th through the 29th of this year.
It's the largest metal bourbon festival on the planet.
It's a big freaking deal, and you're going to be there. We're going to be there. Just send us an email. wearetheStoryGuys@gmail.com.
Don't go to sleep, mother. Don't go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
You know you can get involved in the show at any time just by writing us. It's pretty easy. You go to the email inbox and you type in wearetheStoryGuys@gmail.com. That's what Jeff did. He's writing from Fort Wayne, Indiana, not too far from us, just a state away.
Fort Wayne, what's up?
He says, I really enjoyed the Winger episode. Thank you, man.
I think a lot of people
of nice notes about the Winger episode. It's funny. It's like we'll do 20 episodes with deep, deep subject matter, and we're like becoming scholars, practically degreed in studying, you know, bands throughout history. And then we're like, let's do one episode about Winger. And that's the one that resonates. But you know what? I love it. That's what's fun about this show. Here's what Jeff says. He says, this got me thinking of another band of the 80s that honestly, I just could not stand. Somehow, they have forever been etched in my mind due to the fact that every female I knew or dated loved this band. So, of course, I'm talking about, you want to take guesses?
Nelson.
I'm talking about Nelson. I know they have a huge acting legacy in their family, but beyond that, I don't know much. I find it hard to believe that they were ever caught up in the sex and drug of the time. So was their reputation as pearly white as their hair and outfits? And why were they so big?
I love, hey, by the way, thanks for the letter. Just wanted to say, thanks for possibly understating the huge acting legacy.
Dude, I know. I read that and I was like, bro, do you not know? Like, it is absolutely impossible to tell the story of this band without talking about two other generations of their family.
But a couple things here. Some people might be aware of Nelson and have no idea about anything.
Do you think
about
so?
The rest of that family?
You
yes,
think there's people? Okay, that's interesting. So that makes me more excited to talk about this because this is sort of fun, right? Like, we got to go way back on this one.
Like 100 years.
Seriously, I think we. I mean, it's almost a century. Are there anywhere along that lineage that you get more excited about than other places? Like, are there any people in this family?
I really like Ricky Nelson, and I didn't know how much I liked Ricky Nelson until like I had that transcendent Ricky Nelson experience. And it was how did I miss this guy? Obviously I was not alive, but I clearly had no idea how big of a star he was. So, and I don't think other people did either.
Here's the thing. My main takeaway about Ricky Nelson is I used to say this about another artist that I love, about the exuberance with which this artist played, and I would compare it to Ricky Nelson. I'm like, it's like watching Ricky Nelson. The one thing I remember about footage of Ricky Nelson is it looked like he was really loving what he was doing anytime he was doing it.
Lonesome Town by Ricky Nelson was like earmarked by Quentin Tarantino, and that song probably introduced Ricky Nelson to people, because
yeah,
they're like, oh, who's Ricky Nelson?
I mean, right.
Here's what we're alluding to, if you didn't know. Ricky is the son of Oswald George Nelson, who is Ozzy from Ozzy and Harriet.
Oh, yeah.
And if you didn't know that, like, get shut the front door.
This guy is a very early example of a trailblazer in showbiz, right? He was interested in using his knack for showmanship to make money. And he just like wanted to be in control of how he did this and what he could do with his with his skills. So he makes very deliberate decisions. And one thing that I think a lot of folks do not know, it's been a little bit lost to history, is that much like his son and his grandsons, Ozzy, a musician first.
A lawyer first. The guy knew how to diversify his money. He was doing multiple things.
Dude, we haven't even scratched the surface, right? Like he gets this law degree. And then, like, while he is finishing it up, he gets into playing the sax in local bands to make money. And he's, like, doing that and coaching football or something, right? Like, two sort of disparate things. And he figures out that he not only likes the music, he's, like, sort of into it. And I guess there, like, aren't a ton of opportunities for lawyers during the Great Depression. Because remember, this is, like, 1930. And so his whole life is defined by some category of hustling. But this first big one is pretty noteworthy. Explain what he pulls off here in, like, 1930.
So there's a newspaper contest run by the New York Daily Mirror where people are asked to vote for their favorite band leader. It's 1930, and Ozzy has been playing with some folks as the Ozzy Nelson Band, and he's fairly new. Definitely not in a position to win this contest, but he realizes that if you sell newspapers in the city, the way the deal works with the publisher is that you can return any papers you don't sell for at least partial reimbursement. But to simplify the process, the only thing returned is the front.
So
the middle of the newspaper gets thrown away, and guess where the ballot is?
So, yeah, the guy literally grabs his band and they start dumpster diving for trashed ballots all over New York City. Yeah. Start filling them out, sending them in. That, my friend, H-U-S-T-L-E, that is hustle.
Yeah, that is how Stephen Colbert handpicked the whatever bird to win the bird of the century by stuffing the ballot box by understanding how to do it. So the Ozzy Nelson Band, just like that crazy looking bird that has an awesome sex dance, I needed to say that. Ozzy Nelson Band, he wins the contest, and it puts him on the map. And over the next decade, Ozzy Nelson from Ozzy and Harriet is a big band guy.
Yeah, this is all before TV.
Right. And big bands need singers. So Ozzy has one that's pretty consistent until she gets married, which opens the door for a new woman to start singing along, and her name is Harriet Hilliard.
And in 1935, the two of them get married. They have kids, and by the early 1940s, Ozzy is thinking what so many men start to think when they have kids. Maybe it's time for me to calm it down a bit, right? Maybe I can stop traveling with this band. Parenthood, it's broken up a lot of rock and roll and big bands.
and heroin. So remember, big bands become a part of radio, because so radio is actually a part of society and a part of culture and a part of the family.
So this is still pre-TV in most households, right? So people are gathering around the radio at night.
Pre-TV. So Red Skelton had a show in the 40s, and so Ozzy started showing up on that.
I love Red Skelton. Do you have any relationship with Red Skelton?
I'm really surprised that you do.
I think we've talked about this, but I was basically, as a preacher's kid, told that what I needed to get into pop culturally was either specifically segmented out, you know, through a Christian worldview filter, or was really old, because there were, you know, so many catch-alls in place to keep bad things from getting through when it was old. So, like, radio comedy was totally, that was free range for me. So I would go to the library, or I would go to Cracker Barrel, another great place to grab these things in the 90s, and I would buy these tapes that would have collections of radio shows. And I would collect them. I had a whole bin under my bed that was cassette tapes of old radio shows. We surely have talked about this before on the show. So
no, this is like you exiting the Matrix.
No, like, this is a huge part of my life. I'm not kidding. Huge part of my life. 12, 13.
Oh, I know.
I was very, very, very into this. And this is part of what got me into radio, was listening to radio dramas. So George Burns and Gracie Allen, Fibber McGee and Molly, Jack Benny. Every night when I would go to sleep, I would put headphones on and listen to one of these shows. And one of my favorites, I love Jack Benny, I love Red Skelton. And Red Skelton is the funniest. God, that guy's so funny. And he did these characters. So if you, yeah, if you know much about him, there's Junior and there's like, there's several other ones, but funny, man.
I haven't probably thought about Red Skelton in 30, 35 years, probably.
It's so good, dude. It's so good. Yeah. And I'm sure it's all over the internet now. And honestly, one thing I've not really taken advantage of in the internet age is re-engaging this massive love that I have for old radio comedy. Like, I've not gone back and just started like downloading or finding some streaming service that has all of Abbott and Costello or whatever. But I might do that later.
So here comes Ozzy's hustle again. So he's watching what Red Skelton does and he's thinking, well, I can do that. Like,
yeah.
Why not
yeah.
do instead of doing the other thing, like do your own thing. So this is how freaking long ago this is, everybody. Red Skelton gets drafted. Like, this is the 14th century old. I understand we're in the 20th century, but hearing Red Skelton gets drafted.
And we're not that far back in from the Nelson twins. Like, we're not that far back, which is crazy.
No, Red Skelton makes me think of like the Civil War vaudeville.
Oh, Red Skelton in 1940s. He was excellent.
When I hear about him getting drafted, it's just such a crazy thing to think about because I just see him being funny, you know. So that's the Second World War, right? So Ozzy sees this as a golden opportunity, and who wouldn't? So he pitches the show about himself and his family because they obviously can sing. Get off the road. And if the show is about him and Harriet and the boys, he has to be around them and there's no separating
them. That's what he was trying to do, right? Yeah.
And then I guess it all works out with the money too. But keep going.
So I mean, you mentioned this idea of how weird it is that Red Skelton gets drafted. And it is weird. It's not something that probably would have happened in a lot of scenarios. The backstory on it's really funny. So you know, how does a famous entertainer, one of the most famous radio entertainers of the time, end up getting drafted? There's a divorce scandal with Red. And his wife / business manager basically just comes in one day and is like, I'm divorcing you. And it blindsides him. And in the backstory on him in this relationship is that she's like wife, business manager, and babysitter. Like, he's a train wreck. Like a lot of big personalities, he just does not have his life together at all, right? He can't manage money. There's this story about how she left town for a weekend and gave him $5,000. And when she got back over the weekend, and this was in the 30s or 40s, $5,000. So that's like, well, you know, 20 or 30 grand now. And he's bouncing checks by Monday. Like, he like literally just has no idea about life. Yeah. And so she gets, I guess she gets sick of it. And so when she legally separates, it voids his marriage deferment. I mean, I could legit get into doing a spinoff pod about radio comedy. If this is like an area of interest for people, we could do radio comedy bedtime stories for sure. Because that time period is so fascinating. And and what it grows into and what it leads to. And that sort of leads in this story, right? Like, what does this lead to? Ozzy on the radio leads to what?
The Ozzy and Harriet show, first on the radio, and then it goes to TV, and he raises his kids in the public spotlight. And one of those kids, if you didn't know, on Ozzy and Harriet is Mr. Ricky Nelson.
The first 2 or 3 years, his kids on the radio are not his actual kids. They hire actors. And then once they're like 9 and 11 in real life, they bring the real kids in. And the kid... I mean, both these kids, but Ricky especially, becomes one of the first reality TV stars in a lot of ways. I mean, the show is scripted, but Ozzy starts helping to write episodes at a certain point and openly bases the plots on real things that happen with his kids. And Ricky realizes pretty quickly that he lives in this world where he can like snap his fingers and sort of get what he wants. So when he's 16, he gets this idea. The years later, you and I will both get around that same age. That we can impress a girl with a guitar.
Anyway, here's Wonderwall.
Ricky Nelson tells a teenage girl he is trying to impress, who, like a lot of teenage girls in the 1950s, is obsessed with Elvis. Oh, yeah, Elvis has a record deal, but so do I. So then he goes home and tells his dad, like something straight out of the writer's room, that he would like a record deal so he can make good on this thing he made up for to impress his girl. And so the dad, I mean, again, he's living a life it's a little different than the one you and I lived. His dad can make that happen. So they go to Verve Records. And Verve Records just happens to be signing people who look pretty and can sing, sort of. And so they go ahead and make him a one record deal. And remember, he is living his real life and making a weekly TV show. So these things get wound together very quickly.
Yeah, think about the Monkees and the Archies.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
this predates all that.
Right, but it is that. Like, it's like, we're going to make, here's a product, and we're going to do this. Only it's a little different because it's Rick Nelson. So Ozzy's no dummy. He had to see the appeal of putting this subplot, this rock and roll subplot because, of his son.
And rock and roll is so big, right? Like, it's starting to be so huge. And it's funny, I was just thinking about this period of rock and roll history. And when I was in high school, I was in a play called... What was that play called? Anyway, all I know is the band in the play, in which I played a member with very few speaking parts, but we did get to play live at the end. It was Eustace Early and the Early Birds. And the plot of the play was that in the late 1950s, a girl at an all-girls high school that was a boarding school won a contest through a radio station for Eustace Early and the Early Birds to show up and play. And then Eustace Early falls in love with the teacher at the school. I think that's what happens. But I just showed up and played bass at the end. And that's how I learned the bass line to Rock Around the Clock. But as I think about this, I am reminded of where the fictional meets the actual for television. And Ozzy's literally thinking, he's like, well, damn.
I'm gonna make my kid a star making my kid a star.
And I wonder if it's that or if it's, hey, this TV show will perpetuate if we're like on the pop cultural topic of rock and roll, because that's all anybody's talking about with this Elvis Presley fellow, right? And so they just start writing Ricky playing music into an episode.
Yeah. And I mean, but what if Ozzy's like truly looking out for his son and he's like, I think he needs, I'm going to send some girls his way. I mean,
there might have been some of that. I don't think Rick Nelson ever had trouble with the girls. Well, and this is what happens, right? As soon as they start writing the subplot in, he can basically just go in a high school cafeteria and essentially cause a riot. Like,
right.
Teenage girls show up at his concerts, not because they know his actual music, but because they've seen him on TV. And there's definitely a college-level course in media studies wrapped around the history of this television show and where it intersects with his actual musical career. Like, it's really interesting as to be this far along, 50, 60, 70 years past this, and look back and see what a foundational building block this was for what comes after it. He really is the first teen idol to use TV to promote his tunes. And Ozzy, again, common theme, always hustling, is arguably... Word. The first guy to do music videos, because he decides to start splicing together clips of this kid playing songs is another way to promote his songs.
And here's a factoid that'll blow your mind too. Think about it. Between 1958 and 59, Ricky Nelson had more hits than Elvis.
Oh my God. He had
12 hits.
Oh
my
God. That's craziness.
So Elvis has almost got drafted, but not quite. Overall, Ricky Nelson had 30 top 40 hits between 57 and 62, and that's more than everybody but Elvis and Frank Sinatra. Oh, I'm sorry, I meant Pat Boone. somehow we let that happen.
We did. That happened. Thank you, America. Yeah. The early 60s are big years for Ricky Nelson. He turns 21 in 61, and then he drops the Ricky. He's like, please call me Rick.
My name's Rick.
And in 1963, he signs a 20-year record deal with Decca. They don't hand those out anymore, man.
Nope, they don't hand any of that out. Here's a $70,000 advance, and here's some nails that we're going to stamp all of your fingers and toes into your front porch where your entire life is owned by us.
And we're going to need you to pay us back for the nails.
Yeah, pay us back 70 grand interest and the nails. But anyway, fantastic timing, right? So that deal, 63, the Beatles show up and make all these clean-cut guys less, great looking.
Oh, my God. And amid all of this, Ricky starts dating a family friend named Kristen Harmon. And in 1963, the two of them get married. And you know what they say? First comes love, then comes baby carriages. First a girl, and then in 1967, finally, we're getting here, Jeff, from Fort Wayne. Thank you for holding on and being so patient. We're almost there.
Right. So here she comes. So Kristen gives birth to twin boys. Yes. The very somehow gorgeous, amazing looking Gunnar and Matthew Nelson with their locks of Lochness.
I mean, I feel like we have to say again, I realize I'm repeating myself. The Nelson family is one of the first experiments in growing up in this fishbowl that is American television.
They really are. Yeah.
It's so fascinating. And as you can imagine, being married to Ricky Nelson is going to be weird for a plethora of reasons. The least of which is that you achieve regular cast member status on a television show by taking marriage vows. That happens for Kristen.
Yeah. And that show doesn't wrap until 66. So Chris is the character for the last 3 years of the show.
Just one of the reasons their marriage will be abnormal. One of the other reasons is that the Nelsons and the Harmons were friends and were both in showbiz. And so there was a wee bit of an arranged marriage situation happening here. I mean, it's not an arranged marriage, but it's worth pointing out that a marriage between these two families works out really well for the parents.
Yeah, we haven't even explained who her family is, so here's where we go. Super fun time. So dad is Tom Harmon. He's a college football Hall of Famer, and he played pro ball with the Rams for a couple of seasons. Her mom's Elise Knox. She's the actress that played the damsel in distress in one of the classic Mummy films. And she was a literal World War II pinup model.
Oh, dude, okay. You're leaving out the funniest part of this.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I didn't think it was that important. So Kristen Harmon's brother is named Mark. That's Mark Harmon. Ricky Nelson's brother-in-law was the dude from Summer School, Mark Harmon.
It could not be more on brand for you to refer to Mark Harmon as the guy from Summer School.
as instead of saying NCIS.
The guy like from Summer School.
The show that everyone knows him from. And I'm like, oh, the guy from Summer School.
The guy from Summer School.
Yeah. It's hey, listen, it's a rite of passage. If you haven't seen, like, screw NCIS. I get it. I know why people like it. But Summer School is a rite of passage. It's like The Holdovers, but Mark Harmon is a gym teacher versus Paul Giamatti is the college
You're
professor.
You're comparing Summer School to a movie that's likely to win an Academy Award.
it just felt so good. I looked up like how I was going to watch Summer School, and I already have it plotted out. Like, probably tomorrow night is my Summer School. I'm going to watch it again.
So, okay, back to this marriage. This marriage between the Harmon and the Nelson, additional pressure on it because, as Rick Nelson will let slip at some point in the future, it's also a shotgun wedding. Chris was pregnant with the twins' big sister when they officially tied the knot. By the way, we didn't even say who the twin sister is, or the older sister is. It's the chick from Father Dowling Mysteries. That's Gunnar and Matthew Nelson's sister. Anyway,
yeah.
So there's a lot of things working against this relationship working out.
And it epically melts down. Drama for close to a decade as the couple unravels. It takes until 82 for it officially to end. And I am not making this up. This is not bullshit. And why we didn't have reality TV in 82 for this, he then takes up with a part-time model, an exotic animal trainer.
Is that on the business card? Is that on the business card, do you think? Part-time model? Which one's first? Exotic animal trainer or part-time model?
Excuse me. I wasn't finished. Ricky takes up with a part-time model, an exotic animal trainer that he meets in Vegas, who becomes his personal assistant.
All of those words are my favorite words ever said back to back on this podcast. Okay,
can you imagine that trip to Vegas? Like, that's probably a very wholesome, wonderful trip that you meet like a model and she's got a tiger at her house or whatever. And she's like, you know, I'm really good at organization. Like, what a killer gig for him. 20 record deal. He's got this kid situation.
So this woman, this relationship, it's a source of drama for a long time. Spoiler alert, when he dies, it's a source of drama. She will die with him. Also, spoiler alert. But her family gets pissy because they don't actually ever get married. The status of the relationship is always sort of weird, right? But she's around basically for the rest of his life after the divorce.
So let's talk about Gunnar and Matthew. So they're born in 1967. And so when the divorce happens, they're 15.
Should we apologize to Jeff that it's taken us 25 minutes to get here?
Nah. Hey, Jeff. First, maybe. Jeff, we're sorry. But also, Jeff, thanks for sending the letter and letting us get this long to talk about those two dudes.
It's worth it. I promise it's worth it. We're going to answer your questions.
I got to say something. I totally agree with him. Like, I had this single because you could not, the song was great, but I hated watching them because they did not fit in with everything that was around them.
We'll talk about this. Yeah, we'll talk about this.
Yeah, yeah. It just didn't fit like at all. It was like Debbie Gibson being in heavy rotation as Metallica's One, which I saw today from 89. That was the rotation for MTV. Okay, sorry. I apologize. So Gunnar and Matthew have been playing in clubs since they were 12 years old. And they had a band when they were really young called Strange Agents, and it was a punky pop band. And they get to go on stage and open up for bands like X and the Go-Go's.
And they, you know, they talk about, there's interviews where they're like, dude, those shows were so scary. Because when you play with metal guys, it's mostly theater. But when you play with new wave punk people, they're all on heroin. I didn't document that quote, but I did read that at some point, and I thought that was really funny. Through their teen years, they shift from being in this special agents band to calling themselves the Nelsons. And one of them's playing drums, one of them's out front. That's how that works. And they play LA clubs, but they're like just not really ever getting any traction.
And then the rock and roll nemesis that's happened so much, that's we've talked about so many times, is what happens to their dad. It's a plane crash.
The loudest weekend of the year is back, louder than life in Louisville, Kentucky, with the reunion of Slayer, Slipknot, Motley Crue, Korn, Judas Priest, Disturbed, Five Finger Death Punch, Breaking Benjamin, and Falling in Reverse, with Evanescence, The Offspring, Till Lindemann, A Day to Remember, Stained, Hailstorm, Gojira, Anthrax, and so many more. Over 150 bands, non-stop rock for 4 days on 5 stages, September 26th through 29th in Louisville, Kentucky. Passes on sale now, as low as $10 down at louderthanlifefestival.com.
So we talked about the divorce. That, of course, ruins Ricky financially. And after the TV show, he had transitioned into playing this sort of like country rock thing. He gets credited a little bit in retrospect with the California sound, like being a precursor to guys like Jackson Brown and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. There's some songs you would know. Other people make it way more famous, but he is an early purveyor of that. But by this point in the early 80s, when this divorce finally just ruins him financially, he's mostly stalled out in his career, too. And at 85, he wants to make a comeback. And so he's working on this idea of making this comeback.
And there's no better way to use the word comeback with air quotes around it than to buy Jerry Lee Lewis's old airplane. And that's what happened, unfortunately.
I feel like, I just want to be clear, we're not making any of this up. And I'm laughing a lot in this episode at all of this. But like, this really happened. So this was a total piece of shit. So Ricky Nelson refused at this point in his career to ride on a bus. He did not want to do it. He's like in his 40s. He's not that old. But he's like, no, it's not happening. So I think there was a little bit of this, like, I miss the days of what I grew up with, right? But he doesn't have the budget. This divorce has wiped him out. So the plane he finds for...
It crashes like before it crashes.
It keeps crashing. Like, it keeps almost crashing. Literally, he buys it in May. And it goes down the final time on New Year's Eve of that year. So it was like 6 months, 7 months. I don't know if you knew this. Ricky Nelson was supposed to play Farm Aid. And in September of 85, he misses it because the plane can't get him there.
Oh, because the plane. How embarrassing. God, what year is that?
85.
85. Okay, got it. I was like, if he was the same year as Guns N' Roses, everything in the world would have been amazing. but that's later. It's like 4 years later. So on New Year's Eve, it gets the best of them. It goes down and it kills seven people in that crash. The two pilots were the two that survived.
There's a lot here. If you want to go deep on the plane crash, there's who's to blame and what went wrong. They try to blame it on the heater, the heating unit. That's like a controversial thing back and forth because some people say the heater was acting up. Some people say they don't. Whatever. Obviously, this is a tragedy for the American public, but it's really a tragedy for the guy's two sons because they have said in interviews their relationship with their mother at this point is not good. So I think she always struggled with her mental health a little bit. The divorce is bad. It's not good. These two boys, their career is stalled out. They're just LA club guys, sort of playing rockabilly, and they're 18, but they do have a manager. And thank God that manager has friends. And one of that manager's friends is named Lorne Michaels. And that manager is apparently not afraid to play the pity card for his clients. He somehow convinces Lorne Michaels to let the Nelsons, an unsigned LA club act. This has never happened up to this point on SNL. They've never had an unsigned act on up to 1986, because this will happen in 86. An unsigned LA club act who happens to have an American treasure of a dad who just tragically died in Jerry Lee Lewis's shitty old plane. The Nelsons get to be a musical guest on SNL.
Sorry, we're going to get distracted with SNL for a minute because this is the crazy ass 11th season. And would not have happened otherwise
at
all.
That's true, dude. I forgot about that.
Right. And if we have any scholars and nerds of SNL, then you know exactly what.
Is this the year with the weird cast?
Yeah, yeah. And this is the year after which it was set to get canceled and Lauren begs for it to get another chance. So the cast is Joan Cusack, Robert Downey Jr., Nora Dunn, Anthony Michael Hall.
Anthony Michael Hall was a cast member on SNL?
Yeah, sure. John Lovitz, Dennis Miller, who did Weekend Update at this time, Randy Quaid, and then Terry Sweeney and Denitra Voice. I remember actually watching this episode because the host was Ronald Reagan's son, Ron Reagan.
I was so confused when I read that. I was like, I think there's a certain level, a certain age of people listening who don't know that Ron Reagan was a celebrity ever. Like, that's been totally wiped off the books.
Yeah. The cold open was him doing the risky business Tom Cruise thing with the pink shirt and the tidy.
Also a weird move. Weird move.
Yeah, and as a kid, like, that was confusing for me. I wasn't sure what he was saying to me or what he was trying to say. Anyway.
The Nelsons do say that this night was actually clarifying for them. So supposedly it's here where they decide to shuffle things up and move both of them up front. I believe it's Gunner playing the drums. Doesn't know how to play guitar. And he takes a year to learn how to play guitar so that they can reformulate the band. And he's like, I promise this is what will break us. This is the move. I have to learn to play guitar.
Yeah, he was right. Must be nice. Just take the year off to learn an instrument. But this is 86. And the Nelson that Jeff is talking about in his letter that all of his high school girlfriends were in love with, that band doesn't show up till 1990. So we have 4 years. So what happens in the in-between time?
Do you remember when we talked about Foreigner on the show not that long ago?
Yes,
and
I do.
You remember the name John Kolodner? We talked about this A&R guy.
Right.
Famously, he gets credited on several rock records in the 70s and 80s as John Kolodner, and like instead of saying like play sax or whatever or produces, it just says John Kolodner is John Kolodner. This is a joke, but it's basically like his skill is ineffable. He's really good at telling guys when they have something magical and when they don't. He's going to go on to rebirth Aerosmith in the 90s. If you experienced Aerosmith the way I did, which was get a grip first and then go backwards, it's thanks to John Kolodner. And that's probably worth a whole episode of its own. But Nelson starts taking meetings with him via this. They get this low-level development deal. They hear about him. They seek him out. And I guess because he's Ricky Nelson's kids, the guy's like, sure, whatever, I'll do this development deal. But he keeps basically telling them the songs suck.
Yeah. And they have other mentors in their ears as well. John Boylan, who had produced, their dad says to them one day, "Boys, you've been playing out a lot. You look good. You have this great gear, but without a hit, you're just another band."
And so now let's turn to the show's Bible, and that is Nothing But a Good Time, the oral history compiled by Tom Bajor and Richard Beanstock.
Hallelujah.
And so there is an unbelievable story that they tell. And this is how, so Gunnar actually, this is a quote from him. He says, this is how a typical John Kalodner criticism would go. He would say, quote, "I fucking hate it." And we would say, "John, what do you hate about it?" And he'd say, "You're the fucking musician. Figure it out." So this is what coaching with John Kalodner would be like. And so they start to realize that there is this pattern to what happens with Kalodner. And he doesn't remember anything that they show him. So during this period of time that they have this development deal, they start taking him songs. And they'll show him three at a time, because they also figure out he his attention span can only do three songs. So they'll schedule time with him. They'll take him three songs. And then he will say two of them suck. And the one that he sort of likes, they set aside and they put the other two back in rotation. And then they bring three more the next time. And every time the one he likes, they keep. And they start to build what they will eventually put on the album by having him do this. Like sort of use him against himself, but also helping them. So... oh. They get this opportunity to write this song, and they feel finally, after all of this time, they feel like this is the thing that's gonna, they just have this feeling, and it becomes very theatrical to hear them tell this story. This is Gunnar talking. "Matt and I had gotten to this point where we were down to our last $16 in the bank, and we couldn't eat anymore. It had been about a year that we'd been courting John Kalodner, and he was still taking his time with us, but no money, no commitment, nothing. So we went to our managers and said, 'Listen, we're desperate. We need this. We have to go to the next level. He's not moving. We need to pressure him to do something.' And they said, 'Listen, we're playing this politically. Don't go in there and don't meet with him personally.' And so then Matthew says, we rolled in there without an appointment and said to Kalodner, 'Listen, we know we could be blowing this, but we have a great song and we want to play it for you. And we have nothing to lose at this point.' And we played Love and Affection, which we had just written. And I remember John kind of getting this weird smile on his face, and he was rocking his head through the whole thing, and he was tapping his feet. And then Gunnar says, when it was done, it was silence for like 30 seconds. And then he just reached over and he called business affairs and said, quote, 'Send the check for the Nelsons. They're ready.'"
Oh my gosh. So they get the deal and they hit the studio, but they have a terrible time trying to record this thing. This is an actual quote from one of the Nelsonos. Quote, "It was the best song we'd ever written, but it was a turd. It didn't translate." They end up having to get an engineer named David Hoffman, who does a massive remix, and the brothers themselves redo the bass and the drums and then redo the vocals. We basically retracked half of it, but when it was done, that was the magic that everybody heard. It was the song that started everything and became everything, but it was the one that nearly wound up on the cutting room floor.
So for as long as it took these guys to get noticed, once they have this song, the hype machine is in full effect. And in Nothing But a Good Time, their manager, Larry Mazur, who manages Cinderella and some other bands around this time, tells this story about how he starts just throwing out $1 million as his response, as a joke, when people ask him what they have to pay to be involved with the Nelsons, and people start giving it to him. Like, he says it like at, like literally joking. And they're like, okay, cool, $1 million, cool, we'll get that check to you. And he's like, oh, crap. He makes them a couple million bucks before the record's even out.
And but let's talk about the letter at the center of the episode. And
Jeff.
The sentiment that's at the heart of that letter, which is male disgust at their success. And why was that band so big?
Well, and you said this, right? You're like, it was irritating to you as a man because it took all the female attention. And that's what Jeff is getting at. And these guys, I mean, he's right. They were huge, but they're huge in this really, really weird way.
There are lots of quotes where in retrospect, they realize the image does them a disservice in being taken seriously by anyone other than hot girls.
And no, they're in their early 20s, so that's not terrible. but as they age, it becomes terrible. Right, yeah. So they describe this massive dichotomy in some of these quotes. It's really interesting. Where, like, on one hand, they can go and do an in-store signing at a mall and literally cause a riot. Police will have to come. They will have to shut the signing down. This happened. They talk about being stuck at a signing for 13 hours once, trying to meet everybody. Like, it's insane. But they cannot get a tour. So the idea here, just a little background in the music industry at the time, is the idea is a young artist, you as their manager and as the record label would try to get them on a tour. They would be support for a bigger artist. And so because of the way they look partly and the sound that they're pushing here, even though they're coming from like having played rockabilly and stuff, they pushed them. You mentioned this. It's weird because it was like Debbie Gibson next to Metallica. They looked like metal guys, but they didn't really sound like metal guys. And no metal guys wanted to take them on tour.
Yeah. And their manager comes to them, and this is a terrible thing to hear, that they would have to finance a tour on their own. So they decide to do that. And it doesn't work.
So they have this theory. Like, literally, they put it on sale. Nothing's selling. It's real soft. They're embarrassed. They can't figure out the math here. And so one of them, like, has this idea. Maybe it's because in the video for Love and Affection, which is wild and involved, they said also making that video is insane because they had to do things backwards so that they could speed it forward, if you remember that video.
Uh-huh.
So they don't really play instruments or anything. Like, not in a live setting. So they're like, maybe people think we're not a live band. And so they create another video for their next song, and they make sure it's got this heavy live performance thing that happens, and then immediately they almost sell out the whole tour.
Yeah, it's bizarre, right? Throughout the length of this Nelson tour, they upgrade the sound system twice to give it more power so the band can be heard over the screaming. Sound familiar? Beatles.
Okay, right? So yeah, I mean, that is the comparison. And there were a couple questions here. One Jeff asked was, A, why were they so big, right? So it's a female appeal, it's imaging, and it does them a major disservice for everyone but the females. So we've established that. The second thing he asks is, were they really as squeaky clean as they appeared to be? So this brings us to examine that. And, you know, we just described there were women everywhere on this tour. So when you put 23-year-old men, boys, let's be honest, on tour with a bunch of women, what's going to happen? And so there are some quotes. Jack Ponti from their crew, who was, I believe, in their band, he tells this story. This is a quote from him. One of Gunnar's greatest moments was when he was engaged. He came off tour on Christmas Eve, and his girlfriend picked him up from the airport, and they're driving to her parents' house, and she nonchalantly says, "Hey, Gunnar, did you ever cheat on me on tour?" And Gunnar goes, "Yep." Just like that. Now, there's complete silence until they get to her parents' house, and then she goes crazy. Gunnar runs upstairs, and he's locked in the bedroom, and he calls me and goes, "Dude, help." And I said, "What did you admit it for?" And he goes, "I don't know. She asked."
Well, there's a just being honest.
So Larry Mazur is on record, too, as their manager, saying, quote, "It was tough being married, managing that band. As tough as it was managing Kiss during that period," because he also does that. He says, "With Nelson, it was like Penthouse." That's a quote from their manager. "With Nelson, it was like Penthouse magazine show every day of the week. And those guys took advantage of it, let me tell you." So according to their manager and their bandmates, they were not squeaky clean, Jeff.
I remember watching MTV, and that video stuck out. It didn't fit.
Yeah, yeah. It was. And so what happens to them, right? So what happens after this? I mean, the interesting thing is they're built around this hair metal thing. Record doesn't come out till 90, so they're at the end of it anyway. And their manager is managing Cinderella, so he says, "You should go out with Cinderella." Then they go out with Lynch Mob. This is real stuff that happened. Nelson did this stuff. And it obviously is also, what else is going on is these guys are trying to figure out, okay, who are we now, right? Like, who do we want to be? What can we bring? There's this disassociation between what people expect of us and then like what we have to offer. And so they come back from touring, I'm not kidding when I say, it sounds like I'm making this up. They decide that their next record is going to be a concept album. Here's a quote from Gunnar. It was about the machine that is the media. That same machine that built us up was also ready to tear us down. It is called Imaginator. And so something else happens during this. They don't have John Kalodner. So John Kalodner clearly is the guy who got them where they needed to be Nelson. And he is absent from this process. When they're asked about it in retrospect, on record, quote, one of them says he was too busy making Aerosmith records. So this is the get a grip period. So Kalodner is obsessed with what's happening with Aerosmith and with rebirthing Aerosmith, and he completely cuts out. He's not around. They take this album, Imaginator, to Geffen Records, and Geffen Records gives them an ultimatum. And they say, you record another album, or you don't have a recording contract. And so these guys, as you alluded to earlier, and you know, this is the record industry in the 80s, 90s, not an easy place to actually make a buck as the artist if you're not really playing by the rules. These guys feel, quote, frustrated and helpless. That's how they describe it in interviews. They go back to the studio and they do an acoustic album. And they said it is literally as far the other direction as you can get from what they had presented the first time with Imaginator. And they end up with this album that comes out in 1995. So the first record comes out in 90.
So weird.
Because They Can comes out in 95, Kalodner leaves Geffen a week before the release of the album, and the label does not live up to any promotional commitments. And then they drop Nelson. That's sort of what happens to Nelson. Now, speeding forward, they will independently release Imaginator and a lot of other records over the years, and they continue to tour. They also tour basically now in two different bands. They'll tour as Nelson, and then they'll basically tour playing Ricky Nelson. Did you know this?
I had no idea they were doing their old man's music. That's so weird.
Yeah, but like, I'd go to that.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff, I hope this was satisfactory. Thank you for the letter. We are thestoryguys@gmail.com. If you have a inquiry like this one, or maybe even wilder, that you would like to send us on, please do. We are thestoryguys@gmail.com. We love it. You're a big part of the show as the listener, and we want you to be involved. You can also support the show, patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. And remember, you can go to Louder Than Life Music Festival in September in Louisville, Kentucky. All you have to do is send us your best music festival story at that same email address, wearethestoryguys@gmail.com.
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.